This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Tuesday, October 29th, 2013. I'm Caleb Brown. Is the United States doomed to a long period of slow economic growth? Cato Institute Vice President for Research Brink Lindsey argues that slow growth is not inevitable, but in the short term, it's quite likely. His new paper, Why Growth is Getting Harder, is available now at cato.org. The Tyler Cowen argument, which you've talked about extensively, is essentially that, at least for the time being, we've snagged all the low-hanging fruit with respect to technological innovation and that sort of thing. We've gotten productivity gains that we've gotten them, and there aren't a lot to be had, at least in the near term. And you take issue with some of that.
So, yes, Tyler Cowen wrote The Great Stagnation, where he argued that growth had been slowing over recent decades because, among other things, we've run out of big-ticket innovations, great new ideas for improving consumer welfare. Another economist, Robert Gordon, has seen Cowen and raised him a few by arguing that there's really no great new innovations in the pipeline foreseeable, and that the 250-year episode of modern economic growth is about to run out. I'm agnostic and dubious about any grim future for innovation. If I had to put a bet down, I would bet that the future of innovation is very bright. However, there are other factors that contribute to economic growth besides innovation, and those factors have swung in a negative direction. So even if innovation's future is bright, I'm afraid that over the next 10 or 20 years, we're facing slower than normal growth.
Okay, and why is that?
The basic reason is demographics. The easiest way to get higher output, higher GDP per capita, is to get a higher and higher percentage of your population making GDP for a living. And we did that through the whole course of the 20th century by moving women out of the home and into the workplace. That raised the so-called labor force participation rate. And over the past few decades, it has raised the average hours worked per capita. Ever since the turn of the 21st century, labor force participation has been falling. Hours worked per capita has been falling. Women have come close to catching up with men in terms of labor force participation rates. So that historical episode is really a one-off event. You can only move women out of the home and into the workplace once. We've more or less done it. There's some room for upward growth, but not much, and certainly nothing that rivals what's already happened. So that source of growth has been substantially exhausted. Secondly, if you can't get more workers making GDP, it would be great if you could make them smarter so that an hour's worth of their time is worth more. We did a lot of that in the 20th century, a huge increase in formal schooling, so that in 1900, only 6% of 17-year-olds graduated high school. Now it's 75%. Only 2% graduated college back in 1900. Now it's about a third. So we had this huge increase, but it's slowing down. The growth in educational attainment is slowing down. Indeed, it's gone into reverse as far as high school is concerned. The high school graduation rate today is lower than it was in the early 1970s. The college graduation rate is higher, but only for women. For men, it hasn't moved since 1980. So here again, there's a one-off kind of change. You can only introduce lots of formal education once. We did it during the 20th century. There are scope for further gains, but it's not of the same extent as what we've already enjoyed. So here again, another source of growth has run out or has run low. So what's left is more investment or more innovation. Unfortunately, the investment rate, the net investment rate, has been falling for decades in line with the falling savings rate. So it seems unlikely we're going to have a turnaround and a huge investment boom tomorrow. Finally, there's innovation, which economists measure by what they call total factor productivity growth, which is an increase in output per given unit of labor and capital. This is what Tyler Cowen was talking about in The Great Stagnation. Productivity growth fell in the 1970s, stayed low for a long time, 70s, 80s, 90s. Finally, in the mid-90s, it surged again for a decade. Everybody thinks that's because of the internet boom. But about 7 or 8 years ago, it petered out again. And so productivity growth has been low. So all four constituent elements of growth, labor participation, labor skill level, capital deepening, and total factor productivity are all weak right now. So there's just no place to hide. It looks like growth is going to be slow, slower than normal for the coming years.
Isn't total factor productivity a bit of a thing that's hard to pin down?
It's a really it's basically an error term. It's what's left when economists measure all the inputs to growth. When they've succeeded in attributing everything they can to labor growth or everything they can to capital growth, what's left is total factor productivity growth. So it is, as economists say, the measure of our ignorance. So yes, it's a dodgy number, and it hinges upon trying to measure changes in output over time, and that can be very, very difficult. It's easy for widgets. You just count them up. But how do you measure if you've had an increase in the output of management consulting from 1 year to the next? Lots of intangible things like that that are hard to measure. So the total factor productivity numbers, you always have to take them with a grain of salt. But it doesn't look like the biases in them have been changing radically over time. So even if they're off, they're off by the same amount from year to year. So what really matters is the trend, and the trend has not been favorable.
Well, doesn't that also then, the fact that it is a measure of our ignorance, make it harder to predict what's going to occur with that measure?
Well, even if the statistics were fantastic, it would be a radically unpredictable number because progress is unpredictable.
Now, when you talked about innovation, with respect to education, is part of the problem here that we've got these giant calcified institutions that have for a long time maybe been encouraging young people to go into not particularly productive avenues?
Well, we have government-dominated K-12 education sector and a mix of private and public provision of post-secondary education. Certainly at the K-12 level, we seem to have gotten everything out of a government monopoly structure of education we can. And over the past 40, 50 years, we've tripled the dollars we spend per pupil at K-12 with no increase in test scores and with a lower graduation rate today from high school than we had in the early 70s. So there it looks like we have a system that's broken, and pouring more money at it isn't going to solve it. Will we radically change that system over the next 5 to 10 years? That'd be great, but I'm not counting on it. So my guess is that we're not going to see radical change shortly. Post-secondary education, university education, is a more mixed bag. It's a much more decentralized market. But there again, we've had the slowdown in growth, growth of college completion. Now, for both K-12 and post-secondary, we're in the midst of the early days of what looks like really exciting ferment in terms of the possibilities of online education. So it may be that over the coming years we'll have big gains in accessibility of education and training because of the internet, which will then boost skill levels. That would be great, but I don't think you can count on it right now. I think the prudent thing to say right now is it looks like the growth outlook, based on everything we know, is pretty grim for the next decade or two. Just to put it in context, for the past 140 years, from 1870 to 2010, the average long-term average trend line of U.S. growth is 2% growth in real GDP per capita. And if you look at a graph such as the graph that I have in my paper, it's really amazing how close the U.S. economy has stuck to that trend line. You see a big dip down during the Great Recession. You see a big dip up during the World War II boom. But otherwise, it's just squiggles right along that 2% trend line. No forecasts that I'm aware of long-term economic growth for the United States show us with 2% growth over the next 10 or 20 years. It looks like it's as much as a half a point to a point below that, which is huge when you add it up with compound interest over time.
Michael Clemens is a development economist. He spoke here at the Cato Institute not long ago, and he argues that loosening restrictions on global migration could boost global GDP dramatically. And that's something that that's a one-time source of potential GDP growth. What is the role of immigration in trying to get us back to where we'd like to be in terms of growth?
Let me talk more broadly first. I would say that because these external conditions for growth have grown less favorable, that holding public policy constant, we're likely to experience lower growth. So that's the key, right? Maybe we can change public policy in a direction to improve growth rates. And I believe that at present, policy change is the low-hanging fruit. We know that there are policies that greatly inhibit labor force participation, greatly inhibit investment, greatly inhibit innovation. And if we could change those policies, we could produce a sunnier growth outlook. Unfortunately, we have politics to deal with. So I would say it's low-hanging fruit guarded by dragons. So we know what to do, but it's really hard to get it done. On immigration, certainly we could improve just American growth rates by bringing in a lot of new workers. But to improve growth per capita, you would have to bring in workers that that had a higher labor participation rate than existing workers, and generally immigrants do. On the other hand, those workers would have a lower skill level, assuming they're coming from Mexico and Central America, than existing. So you would have some depression there. So in terms of immediate boosting of growth rates, immigration is probably a net plus, but not a huge one.
All right. Should I really care about GDP per capita if I'm bringing in a bunch of people to do work that I'm unlikely to want to continue doing myself?
So I think GDP per capita is not why we live, right? We live to do to have happy, fulfilling lives, and the real and as far as immigration is concerned, to me, the main issue in immigration isn't its impact on growth rates. It's its impact on human freedom, that there's really no more basic freedom than being able to move from here to there. And so there ought to be very, very good reasons for interfering with that freedom. There aren't very good reasons. And therefore, I think we ought to have comprehensive immigration reform. But as far as its impact on growth is concerned, I think it's favorable, but not necessarily huge in terms of growth rates and growth per capita. Meanwhile, how likely is a huge radical change in the immigration picture? Look at how at what a just a mess the political efforts at achieving immigration reform have been over recent years. Perhaps we'll have a breakthrough, but it's likely to be fairly modest.
There are a lot of economists who say that GDP growth has become something of like this holy grail, and perhaps we shouldn't care that much about it. Is there an upside to not having robust GDP growth?
Not if the lack of robust GDP growth is caused by bad government policies. So the whole point of government policies, the whole point of changing policies, is to make people better off. And improving the size of the pie is a way of making everybody better off. So if we can have policy changes that remove barriers that are standing in the way of people doing what they want to do, and what they want to do is to raise output, then those barriers ought to be removed. Now, there could be exercises of freedom that reduce the growth rate. We have seen those already. So as people get richer, they don't necessarily want to work as much. They buy leisure with their increased income. We've certainly seen over the course of the 20th century, the average hours per week fall dramatically. Back at the turn of the century, factory workers worked 12-hour days, 6 days a week. So now the 40-hour week is commonplace. People enter the workplace later today because they spend all this time in school. They spend a lot longer in retirement, first because they retire early, and second because they live longer after retirement. So all of these are ways of people choosing not to feed the GDP machine, and that's fine. So long as it's a natural process of people choosing to do other things with their time than work on maximizing the dollar value of goods and services traded through the exchange economy, okay. But if we find artificial barriers that are impeding people from doing what they want to do, and the result of that is compromising growth rates, then we ought to do something about it.
Brink Lindsey is Vice President for Research at the Cato Institute. You can get his new paper, Why Growth is Getting Harder, at our website, cato.org.